Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here, and back with us for Garden Talk today, Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Great to have her come by, and we'll be talking about planting trees and shrubs and perennials, and of course, take your gardening questions as we move along. So I hope you'll join in. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Lisa Johnson, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here actually in front of you instead of on the phone for a change.
It's nice to see you in person.
I know, it's so great.
Well, I'll tell you what, this afternoon a friend of mine is going to be buying a bunch of flowers.
Oh, cool.
For all the containers that I have around the house, around the outside and on the porch and so forth. And we'll be planting those probably on Saturday. And planting, it just reminded me about correct planting. Mm-hmm. And what's the best way to what's important to get plants in the ground correctly or in the pots correctly?
Well, it depends on whether you're planting herbaceous plants or whether you're planting woody plants. If you're planting trees, the really important thing is to find that root flare where the trunk of the tree meets the rootstock and it flares out. And that needs to be at either the right at ground level or just slightly above ground level. And it might not be visible if it's in a pot or in a ball and burlap state, which most of them are. So yeah, that's important to find that before planting. Shrubs, that's not usually too much of an issue. And herbaceous plants, not an issue either because they don't have a root flare.
Right.
But with herbaceous plants, particularly the potted ones, not bare root, but the potted ones, it's important to take it out of the pot and look at the root system. If you've got a containerized plant where the roots are going around and around and around, they're really tight together, you should definitely try and straighten those out, feather them out a little bit. Sometimes if something is super pot bound, I'll actually cut off like the bottom half inch or so that I can start to
pull them apart.
Yeah, pull them apart. Sometimes it's quite a job.
Yeah.
But it's important, particularly if it's a perennial, that you give it a good home and you get the roots pointed in the right direction.
What are your thoughts on fertilizer? So let's say you're planting a tree.
For trees, we don't recommend fertilizers at the time of planting. The tree has enough to deal with trying to get the roots reestablished. And if you put in something that has a lot of nitrogen, that tends to actually be counterproductive by favoring leaf production in favor of root production. And you want it to get well established the next year. For young trees, you can put in something. Now, there's lots of advertisement out there about root stimulators and things like that. The results are kind of mixed in the literature. There are some people that really swear by it, and the literature seems to show inconsistent results for those.
So if you want to spend the money,
if
it'll make you feel better.
Now, maybe if you have really crummy soil, it might not be a bad idea to do that, but I'd still wait until the second season.
And of course, we always talk about bare root versus containers. Mm-hmm. Bare roots always seems to me to be better.
Well, there are advantages and disadvantages. The major disadvantage is that sometimes those bare root plants are not cared for as well as you, because I know that places get super busy during the spring and it's easy to miss watering those. They're not in ground. They're in usually some excelsior or maybe some sawdust or peat moss or something. And so often they get dried out. And if that's the case, that can be a bit of a problem. Also, the selection is certainly a lot reduced, but the advantages are, of course, the weight. You don't have to dig a huge hole and haul around a great big bald and burlapped root ball. Also, you can see right where that root flare is if it's a tree. And you can also see the condition of the root system, and you can kind of custom dig your hole. You do have to stake trees that are bare root because, of course, they don't have the weight that the other either containerized or bald and burlapped would. But.
And just going back to that containerized, you see so many that look like a telephone pole in the container, and you really need to get that soil away.
Yes, exactly. Containerized trees in particular, if you see the trunk going into the container or the root ball, bald and burlapped root ball looking like a telephone pole instead of having that nice flare out at the bottom, you do have to do some excavation and find that because it's really important not to end up with the tree being too deep.
Let's take some calls. George in Green Bay, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I was calling because I have a couple unusual, well, they're not unusual anymore, but we went to Europe, went to some gardens, and we saw some espalier apple and pear trees.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, they're really cool. And I was like, okay, I have a 6,000 square foot lot about. And I was lucky enough, we came home and then I came across one. Nobody wanted to buy it. So I bought it for like 20% of the original asking cost. And I'm curious about where to find information to help me to prune it and to gather fruit from it. Because I haven't done so well in the last 2 years. And I also have some columnar apple trees that are kind of the same thing in terms of flowering.
And maybe explain, Lisa, what George was talking about with the tree.
Yeah, so an espalier tree is one that is usually pruned in two planes instead of three planes. So it's often placed up against a wall, especially in Europe where they have a lot of things planted in maybe courtyards where there might not be a lot of space. So it's a type of pruning where you have basically a flat tree, more
flat
or less.
Side.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it takes a lot of work to maintain something like that because trees don't normally grow in two planes. Mm-hmm. They grow in 360 degrees. Mm-hmm. So we don't, unfortunately, at the learning store have a lot on espalier pruning. I do have a lecture that I give on fruit tree pruning where I have some links. If you want to contact me at the Dane County Extension Office, I can send you those. But there are some protocols. They actually do some of the pruning during the summer, whereas most of the time with a regular fruit tree, you would do most of your major pruning during the dormant season.
Yeah.
But when you do things during the dormant season, you tend to get a big growth response. And you don't really want that with espalier because you're trying to maintain it in, you're trying to maintain the growth more of a medium or even a slow rate with that. The harvesting, it's pretty much the same as a regular apple once it's been in the ground, the usual 3 years. Now, I'm assuming this might have been, was this a dwarf or a semi-dwarf, or was it a standard?
It's a semi-dwarf.
Okay.
It's a semi-dwarf, but 6 foot tall. Has each arm, there's three arms.
Okay.
About 4 foot long each.
Okay. And have you got it wired up, or how have you got it in your yard?
I used eye hooks on the fence post.
Okay.
And then I ran a wire between it, and it just flows along it. It doesn't cut into it. I put some
clips.
Rubber over the wire so it wouldn't cut into it.
Okay, that sounds good. Yeah, like I said, it does take some work. You sometimes have to do a little bit of bending or weaving. Usually there's like a couple of rows of wires horizontally that you run those branches along. When they have them along a wall, sometimes they will use actual like hooks in the masonry to keep them in place. But you should pretty much use the same rule of thumb for harvesting, where you have between spurs at least a 6-inch distance, and you would thin the apples to 2 or 3 per bundle. The thing is that you need to be careful if it's a younger tree, not to overwhelm the carrying capacity of that tree. So I would go a little, I'd be a little conservative about how many of the fruits you allow to develop.
Yeah. And as you said, George, you've had it 3 years, so it's maybe this year is the year that you'll start getting a little better production. Good luck.
Yeah, most of the semi-dwarfs take about 3 or 4 years before you really start getting a lot of production.
Appreciate the call. John in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind? Oh, you're breaking up. Sorry, we can't hear you, John. Maybe if we try at a different line, we can get you back and do something. Let's turn to Ron in Trenton, Missouri. Hi, Ron.
Vegetable victory gardens are a partial solution to 3 big problems this year that are in the news. The cutoff of wheat and corn supplies from Ukraine and possibly Russia to the rest of Asia and Africa. The shortage of water in the Colorado River Basin is cutting food production in Arizona and California. And then in the news, they said that they're running out of money to help people pay rent, and they're having to decide to pay rent or to feed their kids and elderly relatives. So if we grow more, if millions of us will plant vegetables, we won't buy so many, and they'll be available for other people. And if we eat millions of tons more vegetables this year, we can share the excess corn and wheat and soybeans with the folks who are going to go hungry this year. Thanks.
Yeah. Ron, those are all good points, Lisa.
Yeah, they absolutely are. And certainly for everybody's food security, we always encourage people to do gardening. That's one of the reasons that Garden Talk is such a great program. So people, even if they are in apartment buildings, if you have a balcony that faces south or west, you can grow things in containers. And victory gardens are certainly a good thing to do. Also, there are programs like Plant a Row for the Hungry. There are food pantry gardens. We have several here in the Madison area that volunteers will grow food specifically to go to food pantries. So those are all great things to look at.
Yeah, thank you, Ron, for that reminder. It's good points. Frank in Lake Geneva, we'll get to you. Hi.
Hi, this is Frank.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi. I bought probably a Concord grape at Costco like 10 years ago, and it's thrived beautifully, but we've never trimmed it properly. We had 2 4x4 posts, probably 12 feet apart, and we had a couple of plants on each end. It's overgrown like crazy, and wondering how to. And now the posts have fallen down. How do I get that into a usable grapevine?
It sounds like you got a project on your hands there. Okay, so first of all, I'm going to refer you to a resource at the UW Learning Store. It's called Growing Grapes in Wisconsin.
It's a really good one.
It is, and because what you're going to need to do is a lot of pruning. Unfortunately, you've pretty much missed the window for this year, especially if you're down south of Madison. Usually your pruning is done during the dormant season, but you might be able to accomplish a little bit. Certainly you can get your cordons back up a little bit, but you need to get your trellises. That's the main thing I would focus on this year, is getting your trellises that have fallen down back into shape, and deciding which pruning method you want to go with, because there are a few different pruning methods that are associated with different kinds of grapes. And in that publication, it does give you advice on the different types of pruning that you can do, and it gives you some really nice illustrations on how to do that.
Yeah,
but
that's
it's a nice one. But it probably will take a few years for you to get that back into shape, probably a couple of seasons.
Probably 2 seasons, yeah. I had a friend, Frank, I had a friend of mine who had a similar circumstance as yours, and I recommend that publication. And he came back to me later and said, man, that was great. He said, I've got grapes like I couldn't believe after I went through that pruning. He followed the rules, followed the directions, and had really good results. So it's the UW Learning Store, and the title is Growing Grapes in Wisconsin.
Yep. You just need to use your internet browser and type in UW Learning Store, and then there's a tab for lawn and garden, and under that is another tab that says fruit, and you can find the, I think it's under berries. So you should be able to find that pretty easily.
Thank you, Frank. Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller with Lisa Johnson for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today as we take a look at our planting season for our trees, shrubs, perennials, with our guest Lisa Johnson, UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. Join in at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Nick and Edgerton emailed to remind us that this time of year, many of the FFA in high schools in our communities are having plant sales. For example, Stoughton's plant sale ended last night, but Edgerton plant sale goes tonight, Saturday, and Mother's Day, Sunday. And many of these sales are fundraisers for FFA members' activities throughout the year. So it's a good thing. And as long as we're on sales, I want to remind everybody, too, that the UW Arboretum plant sale is next week on May 14th. People can go on my birthday
and
buy a plant
in Larry's honor. Yeah. And the Dane County Extension Master Gardener plant sale is on the 22nd, Sunday the 22nd, from 11 to 3 at the Dane County Extension office. And that will benefit our teaching garden.
Absolutely. Well, lots of good ones going on. Scott and Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Scott.
Morning. I have already stratified my yew seeds that I collected from the berries last fall. Do I need to scarify them?
Ah, that is an excellent question. I don't know that one off the top of my head. I would think, though, if they've been moist stratified, that should do it. There is an excellent book that when people ask me questions like that I go to by Michael Durr that is called something like The Manual of Woody Plant Propagation. And it has, you know, all the different conifers and deciduous plants and tells you, you know, if you need to take cuttings, if that is successful, what time of year, and if you need to use a rooting hormone, what time of year, and if you're going to do it by seed, what are the temperatures, and do you need to scarify, and do you need to stratify, and how many years should it take, and so on. So unfortunately, I don't know that one off the top of my head, but usually moist stratification works for quite a few tree seeds,
yeah.
But I would need to look that up to be sure.
Yeah, that Michael Durr book. And Durr is spelled
D-I-R-R.
D-I-R-R.
Yep.
That's right.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a book that's called The Manual of Woody Plants, I think. So this is a different one. It's propagation. So
there you go. Thank you, Scott. Appreciate it. Mary in Waupaca, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. How are you guys?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Okay. Well, my question is about what kind of shrub or small, I guess more of a shrub, would be tolerant of an acidic and moist environment on the edge of a wetland. It used to have pine trees, and they all died. They were cut down. And what I've planted now are some elderberries, because I love elderberries. Mm-hmm. And I was hoping to find some kind of decorative shrub that may flower throughout the year at other times, say preferably maybe in the late summer, fall. I guess things don't really flower then, but decorative, maybe color or something in the fall, but that would tolerate a soil that is fairly moist, and when we have a lot of rain, it actually can flood.
Okay.
And so there you go.
Yeah.
Okay. So the first one I would think of is winterberry holly, which is a native. You need a male and a female in order for the berries to form. Although I think there may be some cultivars out there where they have the male and the female grafted on the same plant. But that is a nice one. Sometimes we'll get fall color. You could also, if you were looking for something that was a little bit bigger, our native buttonbush would be a nice one. They've got a number of different cultivars out there that are actually a bit shorter. There's one that was bred by Mike Yanni up in Menominee Falls, who's from Wisconsin, that I think the cultivar is Moonlight Fantasy. It's a little harder to get a hold of, but it's got great fall color. The other one that's, there's another one I think that he's put out, not coming up with a name off the top of my head, but there's an older one called Sputnik 2. That buttonbush is really cool because the flowers look like these little balls that are about grape size, and then the stamens stick out of them. So it does look like Sputnik. Kind
yeah,
of.
yeah.
That one does tend to die back a little bit every year, so you would need to do a little bit of pruning, but a very cool native shrub. Both of those. So I guess those would be the ones that immediately come to mind. I'm sure there are others if I thought about it for a few more minutes.
Those are a couple of good ones, though.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they would do well. I can't think of anything other than the buttonbush off the top of my head that has really showy flowers.
How would hydrangea do?
That if it's going to flood, that would not be a really good choice for that area.
Yeah, the wetlands flood, but it's a kind of a berm that, it was kind of produced when the pine trees were there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that area itself doesn't flood, but it's pretty moist, when the wetlands behind there are wet.
Yeah.
First of all, the hydrangea that you're thinking of that would tolerate more acid soils would be the big leaf hydrangea, which the flower buds are kind of marginally hardy here. So I'm not, positive that would do really well there. You could certainly try it. If you did, I would recommend trying one of the remontant types. The Endless Summer, but be aware that the remontant character, which is that they bloom on new wood as well as old wood. Old wood plants, like the older types of big leaf hydrangea, the flower buds are not very hardy, and if they don't survive over the winter, you don't get flowers. The idea with the newer ones that have that remontant flowering, like Endless Summer, which our woody plant specialist refers to as Endless Bummer.
Yeah.
It doesn't always flower on that new wood. So it's kind of hit or miss. If they're in an area where they're happy, they can do pretty well. But they particularly do well a little bit south of us.
Yeah.
So what I would do if you really wanted to try one of those, first of all, if it's really hot there, that's not a great idea. They prefer a little bit of shade. They will take quite a bit of sun if they have sufficient moisture, so you're probably okay there. But I would cover it over the winter with a not a black-colored pot because that can absorb too much heat, but cover it with something, maybe a bushel basket over the winter to protect those buds.
There you go, Mary. Thank you so much for calling. Joy in West Bend, on to you now. Hi, Joy.
Hi, thanks. I've got two questions. One is I'm wondering if it's too late to prune our fruit trees. I started pruning grapevines in February and early March, and then we had to pause to make maple syrup. And when I went back to cutting a couple of grapevines that were still live, they dripped on me with a sap.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering about the fruit trees. And then the other question is, I have a flower bed with some daffodils, some iris, and wildflowers that I have transplanted in that area, and a lot of grass. So I'm wondering, how can I deal with the grass and keep the flowers?
Okay. All right. Well, let's start out with the grapevines and the fruit trees. If you're seeing any kind, I'm not sure exactly where you're located, but if you're seeing any green in the buds, silver fuzzy in the buds on your fruit trees, then it is too late to prune,
yeah.
Which usually
Joy's
would
in
be...
West Bend, by the way.
Oh, so she's in West... Okay, yeah. Yeah, as soon as the buds start to swell, then it is really too late to do major pruning for the year. You don't want to prune when things are putting out their leaves or when leaves are expanding or the buds are expanding because it puts a lot of stress on the tree. So that should be mostly done during the dormant season. Now, there are some things that you can do on fruit trees during the non-dormant season. You can certainly take out any of the little skinny upright water sprouts that are in the center of the canopy that aren't very productive. You can take out suckers at the base anytime. But your major pruning and shaping should be done during the dormant season. Now, if there's something that's broken, certainly you can prune that during the growing season. You can do a little bit of light pruning if there's something that's rubbing, but you want to wait until after the leaves have fully expanded to do any of that. And the same goes for your grapes. That should be usually done during, February or March, as you were noting. Now, the flower bed that you have Kentucky bluegrass in it, is that what I'm understanding?
Sure, and maybe even fescue, and also plenty of,
quackgrass, crabgrass.
I don't know about crab over there, but quackgrass.
Okay. Mm,
too bad.
Yeah, that is too bad. that's going to be a little bit difficult to deal with. You can't really use a grass killer because sometimes that can affect plants that are monocots, so like your bulbs. It may not have much of an effect on them. You could wait until like the daffodils are underground, but the irises are still going to be there. That's going to be tough. You might be able to spot treat with a non-selective, but if you've got grass that's like intertwined with everything, your best bet, I hate to say this, might be to just dig up the plants that you want and remove them and then treat the what's remaining. There are, certainly herbicides that you can use. And it's not that I enjoy recommending herbicides, but something like quackgrass is just really difficult to eradicate. You could leave the place, unplanted for a couple of years, and I don't really recommend doing any like tilling because you're just going to rip up those root systems and redistribute and propagate your problem. You can certainly, you know, try hand pulling, but when you've got a really bad infestation, it's sometimes better to just
kind of start over.
Yeah, kind of start over.
Yeah. Good luck, Joy. Thank you very much for calling. John in Mount Horeb, we'll give you a chance. Hi, John.
Hi, thank you. Question about a recommended tree species. We had to remove a couple of ash trees in our front yard. We'd like to replace them with something similar, you know, similar in size and shape. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we love the ash trees, but obviously we can't go with those. So
yeah.
Do you have any recommended trees? And we're in southern Wisconsin.
Okay. So first of all, I'm going to recommend a resource. If you go to the, I think it's the DATCAP page on emerald ash borer. There is a publication there by our woody plants specialist, Laura Gell. And Dr. Gell wrote a publication called Alternatives to Ash. And it includes a lot of trees that are ones that would be similar in size and shape to ash. So that would be a good place to start. Beyond that, let me ask you a bunch of questions. So I'm assuming this is an area that gets a fair amount of sun. I'm assuming there aren't a whole lot of wires overhead or anything like that that we need to worry about. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's full sun and no wires overhead.
Okay. A lot of times people enjoy maples because they have beautiful fall color. So there are a number of the Freeman maples that are fairly fast growing. Freeman maples are a naturally occurring cross between red maple and silver maple, where they have the faster growth rate of the silver, but the nice fall color of the red. Unfortunately, these tend to be kind of overused, and one of the things that we recommend when replacing a tree that was overplanted, such as ash, where we had, like in the Madison area, about 30% of our street trees were ash. Then you get something like emerald ash borer that comes through and takes those
there
out.
There they
and
go.
Then you have a huge problem. And we didn't learn that lesson from the elm trees, unfortunately. And before that, we had the chestnuts. So tree diversity, something to think about. Going on, that might be a choice. If a lot of your neighbors have those types of trees, then you might want to look at something else. There's everything from if we start with native trees, we have some of the nut-bearing trees that I don't know whether you're wanting to collect something like hickory nuts, or that would be something that you wouldn't want having a lot of nuts in your yard. But that's certainly something to think about. If you want to look at non-natives, ginkgos are absolutely lovely and have great fall color. So we have those. If you are looking for something that is going to produce flowers, there are magnolias that are beautiful. A little bit smaller tree, but equally nice in the case of fall color, is our native musselwood. There are a ton of trees that are out there, and we could probably use the rest of the time here talking
poplars.
About. Yep, tulip trees are nice. Sycamores, but London plane tree has very attractive bark. So
lots of options there.
Yeah, there really are a ton of options out there. And I really do encourage you to look for some things that are a little bit more unusual than what you typically see. And there are a lot of producers out there to look through as well. So you should be able to find a good selection. We do have something of a tree shortage, though, that has been going on since 2008, because when the economy tanks, the first thing that goes tends to be, you know, landscaping, because it's something that people don't always have the budget for. So I think, though, that things are starting to come back, so you should be able to find some good options.
Good luck, John. Thank you so much for calling. And Rebecca in Port Washington, we'll go to you. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. I was calling because my husband was given two American chestnut trees from either his great-grandfather, and I'm nervous about trying to propagate them, and I was wondering if I could get any tips on the best way to give these two little seeds a chance.
Oh, okay. I was thinking that they were seedlings. That so they're acorns?
Legitimately seeds.
I'm sorry, not acorns. They're the nuts. Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Okay. That is not, unfortunately, something I have a whole lot of experience with. I would recommend that that Durr book again. I saw Larry typing. Did you find anything there?
I was looking for something, and it hasn't popped up. Nothing is. There are some just online starting plants from seed, but
yeah.
Michael Durr's book is probably the best one.
Yeah. And if you want to contact me at the Dane County Extension office, I can look that up for you. Are these older fruits, or are we looking at something that's fairly new?
No, they're old.
Old. Oh, okay. Yeah, that. And I suppose they have not been like refrigerated or anything. They've probably just
no.
Been...
My mother-in-law found them in a box.
Okay.
Oh, then you might want to try those in pots.
Yeah.
I would try starting them in pots.
Right. I just I'm a little dubious about if they've been sitting around for, 5-10 years or more that they'll actually germinate, but I can give you more detail about those specific seeds if you give me a contact at the Dane County office.
Yeah. Rebecca, good luck with that. I'd be just tempted to put them in pots to get them started. You could always transplant them, because then you can supply the perfect
moisture and so on. I just don't know whether they need a cold period, whether that would help at this point, or if they're so old that they're probably desiccated.
Yeah,
but that would be.
You know what? It's worth a try.
Can't hurt to give it a shot.
Yep. Yeah. Good luck, Rebecca. Thank you so much. Lisa Johnson, our guest today, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about planting season. We're looking at trees and shrubs and perennials. And certainly more than willing and happy to take your questions as well as we move along. And I hope you'll join us. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call from Dawn in Madison. Hi, Dawn.
Yes, hi. I have a very large perennial bed that we had dug up last year. Everything is gone. We covered the bed with plastic the end of the year last year, all through the winter. So now we're ready to kind of start replanting everything with whatever I choose, I guess. But the husband wants to till it up, but there was a lot of quack grass, a lot of weeds. We had milkweed in there I'm trying to still kind of kill because the space is too small for all the milkweed. But to start out fresh again, what would be the next step? As I say, the husband wants to till. I keep saying no because it's going to bring up all of the old weed seeds and the roots and from the old perennials. What would be the next step?
Okay, so let me review what you did. So last year you tilled it once, correct?
We had to take a grass cutter. through the bed because it was that much infested with grass.
Okay, so you scraped off the grass, or I mean you used a sod
cutter?
Sounds
like she mowed it and then covered it.
Correct, an actual sod cutter.
Okay. Oh, you did.
So
okay.
So you've removed a lot of roots, and then did you till it after that?
No.
Okay.
Not yet.
Okay. But after you did the sod cutting, then you covered it, and that was summer or?
That was pretty much at the end of the summer last year.
Okay.
Late August?
Probably July, August, yeah.
Oh, so maybe July.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So I was digging, I mean, literally giving away perennials that I had. There was just way too much. I'm like, okay, I just got to just get rid of all this stuff.
Sure. Yeah, if you went down 4 inches, you might have gotten a number of the rhizomes from the milkweed. Do you have any sense of how far down you went or whether you pulled a lot of those?
I'm thinking in a good chunk of the bed, we probably got them, because when I started pulling up the plastic, there was just basically dirt.
Okay.
Some areas I know we didn't in the corners and such, which I could see would probably just hand dig a little bit of that, but.
Yeah. Okay. My guess is you're still going to have some stuff that comes up, particularly the milkweed, because it's very robust, shall we say. And if you had thistles, likely you'll have some thistles. It doesn't sound like you had a whole lot that is like annual weeds. Am I getting that right? Or it was mostly grass and milkweed?
It was mostly grass, grass perennials, and weeds.
Okay. Did you have a lot of quack grass, do you know?
Probably.
Okay. All right, but the reason that I'm asking you all these questions is usually if you have a lot of perennial weeds, you're likely to have a lot of those root systems left, you don't want to till because you'll be breaking up those root systems and every little bit that you have will be scattered around and you will actually multiply your problem. I'm expecting you will have some of it. I'm hoping that the plastic might have taken care of some of the seeds, if there were seeds, but it sounds to me like most of what you had was perennials. So you're probably going to know within a couple of weeks. I don't know how long ago it was that you took up the plastic.
I only took up a little bit, so we should kind of pull up all the plastic and see if anything starts growing.
Yeah. You know, what they often do, this strikes me as similar to starting a prairie bed is, now, granted, you're not probably going to be doing this from seed, but what people often would do is they'd let the weeds grow up, they'd treat them with a non-selective herbicide that will get both the grasses and the broad leaves, and or mow it and then treat. And then till, and then when stuff would come up, you would, you know, repeat the process. You've kind of already done that in taking off the top layer. Now, have you put down, like, any topsoil or something?
Nope. This is kind of the stage where we're at.
Okay.
And
okay.
I'm getting conflicting information, so that's why I figured I might as well call you and see what you say.
Yeah, my feeling is probably not to till would be better. And if you're probably going to need to do some weed control. I guess what I would do is once you pull up that plastic, maybe pull up a little bit of it, wait a couple weeks, and see how thick things are coming up. If it turns out that you're getting a lot of germination of stuff, you may want to leave the plastic down for another season. if your problem was really severe. If you're not getting too much when you expose the area to light, then you could probably go ahead and plant, but make sure that you put down some mulch to help suppress anything that's in there. And then if you know, have some really aggressive things that you need to either dig or spot treat with herbicide, then
that
would
work.
Yeah. Otherwise, I think if you till, you're probably going to bring up enough stuff that you're probably going to need to for another season is my guess.
Yeah. Or some sort of paper kind of covering.
Yeah, like cardboard.
Cardboard or even paper, that something you could actually plant into and let it all sit there.
What we did when we planted a median strip, we had, you know, the grass was there. I did use a non-selective herbicide to kill off the grass, but then we put down cardboard. And then we made holes in the cardboard and dug out around it so that, you know, within that hole, so that we were removing as much of the materials that were in there. And it worked pretty well if you have, you know, a thick layer of cardboard. But I don't know how big your bed is, and that might not be reasonable for you.
Dawn, thank you. Good luck. Appreciate the call.
Yeah. I should add that one thing I don't recommend is using weed fabric. That's awful.
Yeah, don't use that. Something that will decay.
Degrade. Yeah.
Degrade. For sure. Oh, man. Good luck. Thank you. Mike in Rusk County, your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. How are you today?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, so I realize the explanation might carry over fast news, but I have some forested property that manage forest law right now and whatever, but we did a clear cut recently, and I would like to entertain the idea of introducing a small patch of chestnut. Now, I know that there was chestnut blight back in the day and whatever, but my understanding is there are now some viable options to bring back a chestnut mast bearing varieties or variety. And I'd just like to hear your thoughts and recommendations on that.
Sure.
Yeah, you're right. There are some somewhat resistant cultivars that are available out there. I did do some reading about that, and I'm trying to remember where that research was done. I can see the folder sitting on my computer desktop where, because I thought it was really interesting. And there were, might have been out of Minnesota. Somebody has done a fair amount of research on that. And what I guess I would not plant a whole lot of it to begin with. You know, the thing that I worry about is monoculture, and when you have things that might be susceptible to a problem, planting a whole lot of it might be an issue. But there are some cultivars out there. I saw Larry typing. Did you bring that up? I know there was a university. You know, it could have been Purdue. It could have been. It's very frustrating that I can't remember that. But if you want to contact me at the office, I can get that material to you.
So if you, and Lisa Johnson, if you go type in Dane County UW
Extension.
Dane County UW Extension and Lisa Johnson, you are going to...
you can, it'll bring up our staff page or our website, and there's a directory on it that will have my contact info.
And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate the call. Kelly wondered if you can, she has several hostas and Stella de Oro lilies that have grown to the point they have dead spots in the middle. She knows she can split them,
yep,
be fine. Wondering if she can plant daffodils and tulip bulbs in that dead spot.
Oh, that's an interesting question. I've not not heard that as a suggestion before. I tend to think, though, that you'd probably be better off propagating the actual plants. And, you know, when you move them out of that center area, then you could plant your bulbs in there. But I wouldn't, like, leave the donut, the hosta and the daylilies in the donut form. I would take them and split them and move them a little bit at least.
She was thinking that when the hosta grows, she won't have to worry about the dying foliage looking bad.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. I'm just not sure that will be very successful. Could give it a try, though, at least in one of the spots and see how it works for you.
Be a relatively inexpensive experiment that you could run, Kelly. There you go. Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with Lisa Johnson, the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Gardening questions? What's on your mind? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. And by the way, we have a little survey going. It's one we've done often on Garden Talk. And it relates to this program. It'd take you a minute or a couple minutes maybe at the most to fill it out. And you can go online to WPR.org/Larry and then just click to the link in the program notes right there. So WPR.org/Larry. It's just a question or two about what you may or have learned on the show or maybe how you will use the information. And we would certainly appreciate it if you took a minute or two to fill it out. Let's go to Rosemary in Fountain City next, who has a question for you. Lisa? Hi, Rosemary.
Hi, Larry and Lisa. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two really large elderberry bushes. They're almost like trees. Mm-hmm. And 2 years ago, the birds got them all before I was able to pick them. Mm-hmm. So last year, I really kept an eye on them, and as soon as I saw any hint of purple, I went down there each day and picked clusters. But the clusters were a mix of green and purple, and then I put them in the freezer until I have time, which happens to be right now, or I have time, and then I make a juice out of them and make jelly or just plain juice. Well, recently a friend told me that all green elderberries are poisonous, and she said they damage your kidneys and liver. And I thought, oh my goodness, I better find out about this. It would be a real pain to pick all those little green ones out of my clusters. Is there any truth to this, or is this just idle talk?
That is not something I've heard before, but it certainly doesn't mean that it's not true. I see Larry's working on typing that in.
There is a cyanide-inducing glycoside within the green berries. You can get sick.
Yeah.
Maybe wish you were dead. most people recover pretty quickly.
I'd say pull them out and just if you can still tell which ones they are, better to be safe than sorry for sure.
Yep.
That's that's an interesting thing, though. I know that, you know, there are a lot of our fruit-bearing trees that, you know, apple seeds have a certain amount of cyanide in them, and cherries actually... my friend Diana, I think, was telling me, or somebody was telling me, about horses having issues around if they eat, I forget what it is, fallen fruit or something, something to do with cherries. So anything that's not ripe is...
And the green ones, elderberries, are really bitter.
Yeah.
So you probably don't want them in there anyway. My guess, Rosemary.
What you might want to do this year is maybe use like some cheesecloth or something and put it over the developing fruit once it's pollinated. And, you know, so you wouldn't have to worry so much about birds or potentially maybe use bird netting on those plants. I realize if they're that tall that might be a little bit difficult, but that might be something so that you wouldn't
worth
have that
try.
Problem in the future.
Yeah, there you go, Rosemary.
Yeah, sorry. Probably wasn't the answer you wanted.
No. John in Hudson, we'll go to you. Hi, John.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, appreciate the call.
My question is, I have a shady backyard, probably 50 by 100, and I have a couple tall oak trees there. About half and half shade, half and half sun. And I have an awful lot of moss. I could actually take a shovel that's flat and get sheets of it off. And I'm wondering, how does one get rid of this moss?
Are you sure you want to get rid of it? Because then you'll have bare ground, right?
Right. And then I was wondering, could I then plant?
Oh, well.
I'm thinking of getting rid of it, but...
Yeah, what are you thinking of planting?
You got to have
some sort of grasses. Okay. I used to have my dog there a few years ago, and then he died.
Oh,
so there was a lot of urination and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to get some sort of a lawn established there, but I didn't know what to do with that.
Yeah. My guess is when you have moss growing, that usually means that there's not enough light for grass. If you wanted some kind of turf, you might look at sedges, because usually mosses are going to grow in soil that is moist, a little bit acid, and where it is too dark for grasses. But there are sedge lawns that you could look into. You can still mow it. But most grass species, even fescues, I doubt would be very successful there. You might also think about other types of ground covers, maybe some other native, like wildflowers or something, like Canada ginger or something like that. But if you were planning on having a lot of foot traffic back there, that one probably wouldn't be a good one.
No, I'm surprised there aren't any wood violets back there.
Yeah, that's what I would think, too.
You'd think there'd be a whole meadow of wood violets.
Yeah, we do have a publication at the Wisconsin Horticulture website on moss in lawns that might give you a little bit more information about that, but usually replacing moss with traditional turf grass is not all that successful.
Yeah, the only other thing is to, if you want to trim some branches, open up
the
canopy.
Open up some canopy. Not this time of year, though. Oaks should only be pruned during the dormant season because of the risk of oak wilt.
Yeah. John, there you go. Thank you. Bob in Kewaunee, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Well, good afternoon. I'm hoping that you can be of help for me. I have recently learned that there is a cultivar of a scented geranium, in particular, a rose-scented geranium. And I live in Kewaunee, so close to Green Bay. And so far, I have had absolutely no luck at all in locating a plant or a source of plants from any of the greenhouses or nurseries in this area.
I have certainly heard of it, and boy, I remember seeing it number of years ago at a local greenhouse here. You might have to go online for that, but it does exist. There are peppermint-scented ones. There are orange. I mean, some of these you kind of have to use your imagination.
Yeah.
To me, the orange-scented one doesn't really smell orange to me, but maybe it's just my nose. But the peppermint-scented one definitely does smell like peppermint, and the lemon-scented ones. You know, that was one of the first plants that when I was in high school that we had in our plant room that made me want to go into horticulture because I thought that was just the coolest thing. But yeah, there are a lot of different scented geraniums out there, and I would think you could probably find one online if you're not able to find one locally.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. Aaron in Oshkosh, on to you now. Hi, Aaron.
Yes, hello, everybody. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question about Moonflower Datura.
Mm-hmm.
I've got some seeds from the pods. I had them since fall, and I was about to start propagating them. My approach was going to be to use those little peat moss tablets, keep them in the sunroom until they get an inch or two tall. Do you have any other advice?
I would soak them first. They germinate a whole lot better if they've been soaked. Probably
do it overnight.
Overnight would be good. So about 8 hours usually. I would also use gloves because there are a lot of alkaloids in that plant. And it's also not very tolerant of cold temperatures, so don't be too quick to put it outside. It needs pretty warm. If you do have like a seed starting mat, that could help speed up the germination as well.
Yeah, that's another good tip. Good luck, Aaron. Thank you.
They do germinate though. You know,
yeah.
I had a friend that had them germinate just in the soil outside without any prompting, but I think it works a lot better if you do soak them. So,
thanks, Aaron. Ken in Libertyville, Illinois. Hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to mention that the guy that was having issues with moss in his yard. In temperate climates, I have a good friend that lives in Ireland, which has a very similar climate to, like, Seattle. So, you know, it never really gets that hot or cold, and it's humid all the time. And they have this stuff in Europe that they call lawn sand. And it's not really sand, but it's a stuff you throw down that is somehow moss inhibiting. I don't know what's in it, but this apparently is a common thing in these you know, very humid and kind of cool climates. So you might want to look into that. I don't know. It's a European thing, but if you can figure out what the active ingredient is, then, you know, maybe that would you know, I don't know if there's enough sunlight to grow grass back there, but at least it'll get rid of the moss.
Yeah.
You know, some people, though, like moss, and they actually, you can buy moss spores, and, you know, people actually cultivate it as something that you can walk on. So
there's a reason if there's moss, and it's usually wet and no sun.
Yeah. But, yeah, thanks for letting us know about that.
Sue emailed to ask if you could recommend disease-resistant crab apples for southeastern Wisconsin, any size but preferably smaller varieties.
Okay. We do have a fact sheet that was written by Dr. Laura Gell, our woody ornamentals specialist, that you can find on the Wisconsin Horticulture, the UW-Wisconsin Horticulture website. And that has a list of disease-resistant crabs. There are some new ones that we probably need to add to that list. Purple Prince is one of them, and Gladiator is another one. I sat in on a lecture last year, I think it was, and we had it was for our commercial industry folks, and one of the speakers was telling us all about new research with new crab apples. So there's also a, I'm not sure whether it's international or national, there's a crab apple society though, and they would have more information as well. And the Longnecker Arboretum in Madison also, I think, may still do some crab apple testing, but they have a beautiful crab apple display there.
Julie in Port Wing emailed to say she has heard that lilacs are getting a blight, a fungus or a bug of some kind. Is it supposed to? It is supposed to kill the lilac bush. Have you heard anything about any disease or fungus or insect issue with lilac?
There's always the lilac bacterial blight, and that kills off the new growth. Doesn't usually kill the tree, but I believe Brian has been noticing some uptick in other, like, phytoplasmas or virus or something like that. I have not heard that there's anything that's, like, wholesale killing lilacs.
Haven't either.
But the bacterial blight is something that's been around for a long time, and does tend to cause some issues, but, like, particularly with Japanese tree lilac, although we do see it on the French lilac as well. But no, I haven't heard anything about, you know, total death of lilac plants.
Rick in Prairie du Chien wondered how to get rid of daylilies in a flower bed.
Besides digging them out,
I can dig them out.
Yeah, you can certainly dig them out. They do have a fairly robust kind of tuberous sort of root system. And other than that, I would have to recommend probably an herbicide of some kind. They would not probably go away if you just put down cardboard or something like that. They're way too aggressive for that.
Speaking of aggressive, Kyle emailed, he's been slowly replacing his half-acre lot in La Crosse with natives for the last 10 years.
Oh, cool.
This year, for the first time, he had an invasion of voles.
There are
tunnels all over the lawn and into the prairie beds. Is there something he can do to get rid of them? And what will the plants do? Will they recover after he gets rid of them? He's noticed a lot of natives that aren't up yet. That normally would be by now. Prairie smoke, for example. But, you know, the spring weather was weird.
Yeah, it's been very cold, so it could be that
things are just... I wouldn't
worry
about that.
Behind. Most of the prairie plants have very deep roots, so usually, even if there is some tunneling, it's not a huge problem. We do have a very nice publication at the UW Learning Store website. There's a wildlife tab, and if you go under that, there's a publication. I think it's called Meadow Mouse or Vole, which is the same thing. We do have a few species of voles. They're particularly bad some years when we have deep snow. And they certainly can be very destructive. I did find a couple of years in our teaching garden that they had nested in the, we had cut down the, our Shenandoah switchgrass, which is a beautiful cultivar, and they actually fed on the,
yeah.
the what was left of the cut down foliage, and they got even into the underground buds. So they actually destroyed that plant over the winter. But I think that the publication can give you some tips on trying to get rid of those guys.
There might be moles, too, if
yeah.
you ask me, because those tunnels sound like mole tunnels
yeah.
to me.
If you see, the voles have, like, surface tunnels that are particularly easy to see in Kentucky bluegrass, but if there are actual... like holes that go into the ground and the tunnels are pushed up so that they look like little, like, mounded tunnels, then you're probably right. That's probably moles. Although there are even some other tunneling critters like 13-line ground squirrel that
can do it too.
Can do it too.
I wanted to mention all this talk about prairies and so forth reminded me of our event tomorrow. We've got a WPR event tomorrow. It's a meetup at the Retzer Nature Center in Waukesha, which is a free event. It's just to say thanks to the many WPR fans we have in Southeast Wisconsin. So, and I'll be there. You can stop by about 10 a.m., 10 to noon. We'll have coffee, donuts, conversation with me. Sheila Shigley will be there from Simply Folk. Trina LaSousa, I know, is going to be there. Let's see, Mackenzie Crummy is going to be there from our Milwaukee offices. So you can pick up some WPR swag and check out some of the activities. We're going to have games and an art project. We're going to have a s'mores station. I'm going to hit that one. There'll be some hiking and a whole lot more. So it would be helpful if you went to WPR.org and clicked on events. You can just register for it. Just gives us an idea how many are coming. But
don't want to run out of donuts.
No, I'll be there early, and I'll probably get one of the first ones out of the box. And, you know, we can have some pictures together and just some good conversation. And it's just a thank you for all you have that you do for Wisconsin Public Radio. And it's, you know, as long as we're here on Garden Talk, it seemed like a perfect time to talk about it once more.
Yeah, Retzer's beautiful. So, yeah, that sounds like a lot of fun.
It'll be a lot of fun for sure. Well, I'll make it fun.
Anywhere you are, Larry, it's going to be fun.
Lynn in Waukesha, by the way, emailed you should have. This had to do, was it chestnuts? I forget the, it had the old nuts.
Oh, right. Yes.
Chestnuts.
It was a chestnut.
Lynn says, be sure to soak those old seeds overnight before.
Yeah, hydrate them.
And hydrate them if you're going to give it a shot before you plant them. And Lynn's in Waukesha. Well, Lynn, maybe we'll see you tomorrow over at the Retzer Center. Oh, man. And let's see. Did I have one other one that I wanted to bring up? The UW Arboretum Plant Sale on the 14th. And Shirley suggested that lasagna gardening might help. If you got a bed of grass, maybe some.
Yeah, bury it.
You can just bury the darn thing.
You need to put quite a bit of soil on top of it, though.
Yeah, that would be.
Depending on the size, that might not be doable, but maybe if it's a small area.
Oh, and Angela emailed for the gentleman looking for scented geraniums. She says, Select Seeds has a nice variety.
Oh, cool.
Of them. So there we go. Select Seeds, nice variety of scented geraniums. So Select Seed Company is going to probably
have a run on.
Having a run on. Where the heck did all this come from all of a sudden? Oh, Lisa, it's always a pleasure.
Great to see you, too.
Great to see you. Thanks so much. And you'll be back and we'll do it again.
All right.
Hope so. We will. Just looking ahead here, tech expert Jesse LaGrube is back on Monday to talk about your computer and about docking stations. They might really work for you. And, of course, he'll answer your tech questions. That's Monday starting at 11. Don't forget, now that the show's about over, click on our little short questionnaire. Just go to WPR.org/Larry. It'll take you a couple of minutes just to fill out that little survey, and it has to do with today's program. So we'd love to get as many folks as we could to ideas at WPR.org/Larry. It's WPR.org/Larry. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.